cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 252nd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 251 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that on Thursday, November 1st, is the weekly meeting of the Mayapak Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mayapak Library on Route 6 in Mayapak, New York. More than 100 books have been published by writers from this group. People wishing more information may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. But I hope you join us next week at the same time for an interview with poet, editor, artist, and photographer Alexis Rome Fanchia, poetry editor of Culture Weekly, and every week at this time. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 252nd in the series, my guest is poet, critic, editor, and musician T.R. Hummer. While I've been the Facebook friend of Terry Hummer for a number of years, this is the first time that we've actually spoken, and I am very interested in following his career all through the United States. The listeners wishing to join Terry and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I've generally called participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Okay, so let's get started. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you very much, John. I'm glad to be here.
Would you start us off with the poem?
Sure. I can start off with a poem from a new book called After the Afterlife that came out this year. And this poem is called As for the Housefly. As for the housefly bashing its head against the kitchen window, its sentience is a quasar. It has lived 20 fly years trying to understand transparency, while for me, only half a day has passed since it blew in the back door while I was getting the mail. But I hear the cosmos howling fiercely inside its minuscule cranium. Time is compressed in its soul like like neutrons in plasma. When I walk across the kitchen, I am continental drift. I move my arms like a spiral galaxy. No wonder it is frantic as I open the pane. How long must it take for the air to cool and the sun to sink into its consciousness? How long for the speed of light to change?
I like that, and it reminds me so much of periodically we have blue jays that fly into our glass door in the front of the house when we have the regular door open, and it's amazing that they don't recognize from all their experience of flying around that this is solid. And a couple of them I've picked up, and they've flown away after they right themselves. But we had one that killed itself by flying in, and it's the same obviously with the insects and everything that get caught where they don't belong. So
I guess so, it was for me interesting to speculate on the nature of the creature's consciousness in that situation. I mean, for me, the question arises about, you know, the consciousness of other creatures, but also of everything else. And it's possible, it seems to me, that even stones have a kind of consciousness that just may move very, very slowly compared to us. So in sort of reversing that proposition, the housefly's consciousness perhaps moves very, very fast, making us look like stones by comparison.
Yeah, and we feed all sorts of animals here, squirrels and groundhogs and deer and birds and everything. And it's amazing that they, as soon as open the door to feed them, they all take off. And they don't, after a number of years, they haven't gotten it that I'm bringing the food. And it's amazing to watch these squirrels go up the trees and the groundhogs with these short legs go running off. And I think of in New York City where there's actually people in Central Park that feed the squirrels to come up to them. And I don't know how many years it's taken to break down their concern for humans, that the ones in the country here have not had that that exposure. So
yep.
Part of it's, I guess, evolutionary, depending on where they live.
Yeah, and maybe they're very intelligent, actually, to run away from humans, all things considered. I sometimes run away from humans myself.
Sure. Oh, where'd you grow up and then go to early school?
I grew up in Mississippi. I was born in Mississippi in 1950, in the bad old days. And we lived in a very rural part of the state. There was a family farm where we lived. Very far from almost anything. The nearest town was 15 miles away, and it was the county seat, but consisted of about 3,000 people. So you can understand how unpopulated that part of the world was. And I went to school in that town, in a consolidated county high school, or rather school system. It was, you know, the same school, because it wasn't very big, the same school from elementary all the way through high school.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
My earliest aspirations were to get the hell out of there. That was a very early aspiration of mine. But in terms of what you mean, actually, one of my earliest aspirations was to be a writer of some kind. I had no idea what it meant, really. But as soon as I was aware that these things called books, which were so engaging, were actually not natural objects that grew on trees or something, but they were actually made by humans. I thought it might be a good thing to be a human who made books. What that meant in terms of, you know, what one does, I had no idea, because at the time I was probably about 5 years old and I just taught myself to read comic books. But I remember one day my brother, who was older and of a very different disposition from me, much more practical, he's an engineer, he was 9 or so, and I was 5. He said to me, "What do you think you might want to do when you grow up?" And I said, "Maybe I want to be a writer." And he said, "Oh, don't do that." I said, "Why not?" And he said, "What if you write something and nobody wants to read it?" Which is a good question.
It certainly is. And so much out, or I do anyhow, that's rejected, and eventually it's hopefully most of it gets taken. But you have to, one of the things that we always tell young writers is you have to get used to being rejected and to keep honing your craft and to keep doing it over. But that's hard for some people to understand, the marketing element, that you have to know where to send things, that you don't send something about politics to a comic magazine, perhaps, or you don't do certain things. And it's interesting. It's I guess that we all have to deal with that.
Well, it's complicated. Though, in fact, in response to my brother, at this point in my life, and now I'm 68 years old, so that gives me another 63 years to have thought about what he said at the time. I would say it turned out that I did in fact enter a field of writing that almost nobody wants to read, and it's not a question of trying to get it published. And that's not what I mean. What I mean is that the following for poetry in this culture is very small, and that fact I have made peace with. In fact, I never really had to make peace with it because it was not a surprise to me. Some people seem to have to make peace with it, but for me, it's not really that much of an issue, you know. And so that's something that it took me a while to figure out that I felt that way about it, because I never really thought about it when I was young, when I was a young writer. I was just excited about the process and excited about writing poems and in love with it. I fell in love with it very early on. And furthermore, it was a lifeline for me out of a difficult cultural situation where I grew up in deep rural and in those days very racist Mississippi. At some point in my life I realized that was not who I was, but if I said so, then I was in danger of becoming the enemy, if you see what I mean. And so
sure.
poetry is something that I discovered as a kind of personal secret, you might say. Nobody around where I was really paid any attention to it except me. And that was the virtue of it as far as I was concerned, that it was mine. Of course, that was not true. It was an illusion, but it was true where I was. And I carry that sense of it with me now, that poetry, it's not that I don't write for other people, because of course I do, but in my head, the reader I write for is one person, one abstract person somewhere, who will discover the poem and read it and find in it something worthwhile, something useful, something to save them from the situation they might happen to be in, maybe.
In one of my poems, I quote Billy Collins, quoting Joyce Carol Oates, who said that as many people are people who write poetry as read poetry, and Billy Collins said that she's wrong. More people write poetry than read poetry, but
I came to it late after
being a columnist and a journalist and everything dealing with technology. It was just to a quirk that I came to it, and then it put its arms around me and it captured me. So you were an early reader, and you mentioned the area that you grew up in. Your early years were spent in a segregated society. What do you remember about that time, and how has it infused your writing since then? Do you know?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. Of course, it's difficult ever to see the entirety of a situation from all sides anyway, but it's especially difficult when you're talking about the place where you were born and came to consciousness and came to love things and to be taught also to dislike other things and to be defined as a human in certain ways. Having thought about it very carefully for a long period of time, I realized that, well, I knew at the time that the school I was in was a very poor school. That was obvious to me almost from the time I started going to it. It was clear that what was going on there was not very well done, and that the people who were doing it weren't very passionately involved in pedagogy and teaching the young. And it was also clear to me that my peers were not very interested in what we were doing. So I became not very interested in it, too, because why would I be? But as time passed, I began to be interested in certain kinds of things and wanted to know more about them. And I realized that I was not going to get any help from the school. You know, I had to educate myself, ultimately. Because, and this is the important because, in that little town, now, you must understand that in that county in Mississippi, I don't know what the population of the county was exactly, but as I say, the county seat was less than 4,000 population. The county, nevertheless, was 70% African American, but white people owned everything. White people had all the power, and black people basically worked for white people, you know, that, and for nothing, for the most part. Certainly on the farm where I grew up, when I was born there, there were probably 80 people living on that farm, of whom about 65 were African American. They were all sharecroppers and lived a subsistence existence mostly. It was the archetypal sharecropper cabin thing. That was our farm. It wasn't a plantation, you know, where it wasn't nearly as grand as that. It was just a place where none of us had much, but certainly the white people had more than the black people, and the black people had far worse lives, and I can't pretend to be able to fathom exactly what their particular suffering was like. You know, I don't know. From the white side, I can say this, though, that growing up there, being a child there, was damaging, because if a person in a situation like that thinks one clear, rational thought, the whole system falls apart in his or her head, because that kind of institutional racism is absurd on the face of it. One must not, therefore, think one clear thought. One must be prevented from doing so. Or to put the matter another way, Ralph Ellison said that in America, African Americans are invisible, the invisible man. But I maintain that's obviously not literally true. If African Americans seem to be invisible to white people, it's because white people are blind. And that means that in order to keep your children like you, to keep them from seeing clearly, you have to put out their eyes. And that's what the educational system was doing. I realized when I was in my 20s that I was not capable of thinking sustained thoughts in a rational way. It was amazing. I would try to think, and it was like my mind was a rusted machine. The wheels wouldn't roll. And it took me some years to get over that once I realized it.
Staying with that, though, you said that you realized that you had these understandings that were different than many of these kids who went to school with you around. What in your background made you realize this? What in your background made you escape to poetry? Was it the family? Was it a religion? Because 5 years old is pretty young to recognize that there's something weird here.
I didn't recognize these things when I was five. I didn't really start to recognize them rationally until I was in my teens. I started reading when I was five and thinking that I might be a writer, but these other things didn't begin to emerge until later. And, for me it was salvation that when I was 10 years old, it was 1960. And therefore things were starting to change. You know, the civil rights movement was out there. In fact, Mississippi really was a war zone in those days. I lived 40 miles away from Philadelphia, Mississippi, where those three civil rights workers died. And 40 miles from my backyard, it might as well have been in my backyard. It could have been. I mean, there were people around who would have done that. It was, in fact, a kind of cold war zone. The shooting only broke out once in a while. But nevertheless, there was tension. You know, the air was thick with it. And black people and white people drew apart in that place in those days. When my father was young, my father grew up in a Faulkner novel. When I read Faulkner's Go Down Moses, I think, yeah, that's my dad's world. You know, he lived in that world. But that means that he was in and out of the houses of the African Americans who lived on the farm, and they were in and out of ours, and people kind of, you know, it was all very stratified. It was a caste system, and everybody knew who they were in that caste system. But given that, there was a lot of interaction. In my youth, there was not. There was tension. People were afraid. Nobody said so. People didn't talk about it much, but it was there. And another salvation for me, therefore, was, or, well, not another, but it's a sort of, it's a way that this became patently clear to me. My dad had bought in 1954, if memory serves. I think he brought it home for Christmas in 1954, because the first thing I can ever remember seeing on television was Eisenhower's Christmas tree lighting. You know, and this little black and white set that my dad bought. He turned, you know, he got the antenna on the roof set up. It had a rotor on it, so he could turn it. We could get 2.5 stations out there. So he tuned it in and turned it on, and the first thing that came on was the lighting of the Christmas tree at the White House, which in black and white is a very unimpressive thing. But, you know, it was a miracle as far as we were concerned. So we had this television set. My dad was a news junkie. He would watch the 6 o'clock news every day and sit in his chair swearing at people like Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and Kennedy and so on and so on. And I would sit listening to them. You know, I'd sit and listen to Dr. King speak, and I'd sit and listen to my dad speak, and I'd think, you know, Dad, I didn't say this, but I think it. Dad, Dr. King makes a lot more sense than you do. So that the civil rights movement was present, so to speak, in the house, both in terms of its scariness to those who wanted to hold on to the status quo, and in the sense of its power. And in the sense of its rationality, you know, what Dr. King was saying to me made eminent sense. And I could sit there and listen to him quietly while my dad sat there and heard something entirely different, apparently. And that fact was interesting to me, too, you know, that he was processing what he was hearing so differently than I was. And so, you know, I began to feel that I was, should we say, in the wrong place somehow.
It's interesting that even in the same family, when I wrote Jimmy Carter's autobiography, they had a peanut farm, and well, these black folks lived on it, and Miss Lillian would invite them into the house. When she invited them into the house, his father would leave, and when his father would meet with any local politicians or any ministers, he would meet with them on the front lawn. So Jimmy Carter grew up seeing his mother behaving one way toward black people and his father behaving in another way, which I thought was very interesting. Yeah. How about your high school years? Did you write for a school paper or for a literary journal or anything?
Literary journal? Are you kidding? There's no
okay.
Literary journal. We barely could. We barely had paper. No, that's not true. But no, there was no. It was too small a school to have a literary magazine of any kind. Nor was there any kind of permanent newspaper in that school. You know, people would sort of create little short-lived personal projects that were kind of like newspapers, but the school did not sponsor a newspaper. You know, there was no attempt at journalism of any kind there. And one's literary activity was entirely limited to English class. That was it.
And what happened after high school for you?
Well, after high school, I went to college because that's what we were supposed to do. My father's generation of my family went to college but didn't finish because they were interrupted by the Second World War. And my dad graduated from high school when he was 16 because he started first grade when he was 4 because they had a one-room school out near the farm, which several of the farm families operated out there. And they didn't have enough students. They needed one more in order for it to be officially sanctioned by whatever state regulations were in place at that time. We're talking about 1925 or so. So I guess they said to my grandmother, we need another student. Can Vernon do it? Vernon being my father. And my father was a bright man. He was an intelligent guy, and so, you know, even at 4, it was clear that he was smart. So my grandmother said, "Well, I think he could do it. You know, let him try." So they admitted him at the age of 4 to first grade, which means that he finished high school at the age of 16. He went to the nearby, what we call junior college, what now you would call a community college. He finished there, and then he went to Mississippi State for a while. But in that junior year, his entire class enlisted, because that was Pearl Harbor, right? And so when that happened, the whole class enlisted. It was all men. I mean, Mississippi State was an all-male school at that time. So they all left. And when he came back, he didn't go back to college. He immediately got married and went back to the farm and started having children. So point being that when my generation came along, they all wanted us to go to college, even though I think unbeknownst to them, they hadn't really thought this through. It meant that none of us were going to come back to the farm. And that farm had been in our family for several generations. And now we're all gone, and the farm has been carved up and sold because we all went off and studied at school at universities. But that was very much what they wanted us to do. Nobody really thought about where we should go or what we should do when we got there or what it meant to go to college. That was not on my radar at all. And I had kind of a rough landing in college because I had really no idea what I was doing. And it took me a couple of years to get my feet on the ground. But once I did, there was no looking back. I had realized that for whatever reason, universities were my new home. And once I was a student in university, I never left the university for very long.
So what did you major in college?
Well, I majored in English, as you might expect.
I was, too.
Oh, yeah. And one might say, well, that's too bad. But it wasn't. It was the perfect thing for me. I majored in English and did an undergraduate minor in philosophy, which was really an oddball move for somebody from my background, because I really knew nothing about philosophy going in. But I became interested in certain things. And I got by quite well in the philosophy classes I took at that school. Well, by this time I was at University of Southern Mississippi, because I realized that Mississippi State, though it's a fine school, it was not the right place for me. It's an engineering school primarily, and they do more humanities at Southern Miss. So I went there, and it turned out, unbeknownst to me, that there was a creative writing program there. So, I fell into that almost by accident, and that was very useful. But in the philosophy classes, the philosophy professors liked me because, not because I was good at philosophy, because I wasn't, but what I was good at was at mimicking the writing styles of philosophers. So if we were studying Kierkegaard, I could sit for hours and read Kierkegaard and not understand a word. But when time came to write a paper, I could write a paper that sounded like Kierkegaard. So they would give me A's for that. And they thought I was terrific. So then, I did that for a while.
It's interesting. I started as a philosophy major. And then after 1 year, after my first junior year, I noted that there weren't many jobs in New York Times for philosophers. So I switched to something much more practical, English literature. And then I was, with a quick detour to law school, I was lucky that I wound up in technology for 50 years, which I really took to, and that led me into writing, into college teaching, and then eventually to poetry. And what came next after college?
Well, I was extremely lucky, really, because, as I say, I went to college without any sense of what I was doing. I wanted to go. I felt that it was the right next step for me after high school, and that it would be something completely different, which is what I wanted. But beyond that, I really had no idea what I was doing. When I got to the end of my undergraduate work, and I had really kicked in as a student, the high school where I went did not prepare me for anything. I got by that high school very easily. I was a bright kid, and I could do everything they wanted me to do, with my right hand tied behind my back without having to make any effort at all, except Latin. That was a little difficult. But the rest of it, it was not a problem. When I got to college, I was called upon to actually study, and that was not something I knew how to do. So it took me a little while to figure that one out. But once I figured it out, And once I figured out what I wanted to apply it to, then I was a very, very good student. So when I got to the end of my undergraduate work, I had, as I say, fallen into the creative writing program at University of Southern Mississippi, and the guy who was in charge of it called me into his office one day and said, "Hummer, we're starting up a graduate creative writing program, and I think you'd be a really good candidate for our master's." It was not an MFA. They had then ultimately a master's and a PhD track, like the University of Denver, which is where the guy who designed it came from as an academic. So anyway, he said to me, "I think you'd be an excellent candidate for this." And I had no idea what graduate school was. I don't think I'd ever heard of graduate school at that point. And so I said, "Well, tell me about it. Let's talk about this." You know, and so to make a long story short, I became a student in the master's program in creative writing and finished that. When I got to the end of that, I took a job for a while in the Mississippi Arts Commission. Now, we're talking about 1974 now, and at that time, you'll probably remember when the Poets in the Schools program was everywhere, right? You
yeah.
remember that? When the National
yep.
Endowment
oh, yeah.
of the Arts was sponsoring that? Well, the Mississippi Arts Council was doing a kind of scattergun Poets in the Schools program, which was, and I was working in that. The director of the Arts Council reached out to the guy, my mentor at Southern Miss, who was running the creative writing program, and basically she farmed out the creative writing program to him. The Poets in the Schools program to him. They said, "You have poets, we have need. Put your poets in our schools." And I was one of their poets, and so they put me into some elementary schools to work with young kids, which was fun to do, and it was also some income, you know. So at some point, they wanted to stop just farming it out to USM and run it themselves, but they had to hire somebody to direct it. So they ended up hiring me to do it. But I ran not only the Poets in the Schools program, I ran a comprehensive program called Artists in the Schools, which placed poets and craftspeople like potters and so on. Pottery in the schools was actually a very successful program. We placed dance companies in schools. We placed musicians in schools, you know, that kind of thing. And so for 3 years, I administered that program from Jackson out of the office of the Mississippi Arts Commission, which actually was one of the best jobs I've ever had in terms of being interesting and fun. I met lots and lots and lots of artists who I wouldn't have met otherwise. I became very good friends of theirs. I liked colleagues in the office. They were all terrific people. The only problem was that it was working for the arts in the state of Mississippi, you know, which is not a growth industry, and you know, it was not very well paid. And by that time, I was married and had a child on the way, and I thought, I need more money. I know. I'll become a graduate student again. So then I went off to the University of Utah to study creative writing some more.
Utah must have been about as different as possible as any place in the United States could be from Mississippi. Was it a real culture shock?
Well, you know, that's an interesting observation, and you're right. I mean, particularly in terms of the landscape, of course, it was like moving from the wilderness to the moon. but obviously, Utah is a very beautiful place. Salt Lake City in those days, Salt Lake City's changed, but in those days it was, as you would expect, it was a town dominated by the local religion, you know. And I knew nothing about that. I mean, Mormonism was a very distant rumor to me. But the way I dealt with it going in was, well, I've been living with Southern Baptists all these years. Can it really be that different? Well, yeah, it can.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, the cultural climate in Utah as a whole is not that different from the cultural climate in Mississippi as a whole. They're both very conservative places and dominated by a certain kind of religious culture, a very different religion, it must be said. But, you know, nevertheless, So in that way, it was not so unfamiliar. And University of Utah is actually a terrific school. I mean, I was lucky. I went there because there was a particular poet with whom I thought I should study. And I turned out to be right about that. He was, in fact, a very good mentor for me at that point. But I, you know, if I were doing this all over again now, you know, it would be a very different thing. Choosing a university now is like a full-time job. You know, I have a child now who is my youngest child is a junior in high school and is starting to look. You know, when my older daughter was at that point, she applied, I think, to 50 colleges, you know, and went and did all these campus visits and so on and so on. And I did none of that, you know. And most people I knew when I was a kid, when I was that age, didn't do that. And now it's of course something that you do, and rightly, because it's obviously a very, very important decision, and it's a very competitive process now in a way that it wasn't in those days as much. So anyway, I didn't even apply to more than one school. I had a friend, a poet, who was working in the Poets in the Schools program with me, and he said to me one day, you and I should get into a good creative writing program, probably a PhD program, because if we get a PhD, we'll be able to get an academic job without a problem. And I said, well, you're probably right about that, Harry. What do you think? And he said, well, I think we should go to the University of Utah and study with Dave Smith. And so I said, well, let me look into that, because I knew Dave Smith's poetry. So I did a little research and came back to him, and I said, well, I think that's a good idea. Let's do it. So we both moved our families out. We both applied, and we moved our families to Salt Lake City. That was it. You know, that was the whole process, which when I look back on it now and consider how people now make these decisions, I'm stunned that it was that
sure.
simple. For me, but it was, but in fact, it was again the right move. It was a good place for me to be. I learned an enormous amount, and it changed a lot of things about the way I thought, not only about poetry, but also about lots of other things.
What was your PhD concentration? What was your dissertation?
Well, they have there, as they do some places, a PhD with a concentration in creative writing. But, of course, it comes with a very, very strong dose of literature classes. And, in fact, the first semester I was there, I took a workshop with Dave Smith. I was part of the first group of students that he himself picked. He had just moved there a year before, maybe 2 years before. But he had selected this group. And of a group of 12, six of us had already published books. And so it was a pretty strong group. The poet Bruce Weigel was part of that group. The poet, he's known as a poet of Vietnam. He was in Vietnam, and after he came back from Vietnam, he went to Oberlin, and as an undergraduate, studied creative writing at Oberlin. Then he went to University of Utah, where we coincided. The poet Irene McKinney, who was for years the poet laureate of West Virginia, was in that group. And so it was a very strong group, and not a group, and it was sort of an obstreperous group, I got to say, too. There was a lot of back and forth. And Dave, in those days, was a very tough teacher. And so it was a trial by fire, as you might say. And my friend, the poet who moved there with me, he didn't make it. He bombed out and left. After having moved out there, you know, at the same time I did, he loaded his family back up in the truck and moved back to New Jersey, which is where he was from. And, you know, that was a good decision for him. It was what he needed to do. But for me, it was a kind of break or make or break moment because I thought, well, gee, my buddy is leaving. What am I going to do? Do I need to leave too? And I thought, well, I don't think so. So I stayed with it. But anyway, my point about that was that after that one workshop, I didn't need any more workshops. That workshop was it for me. I took it. I got from it what I needed as a poet that you can take from workshops. I took one more workshop after that, and it just didn't do anything. And so I thought, okay, that's it. Just studying literature the rest of my time here. So, in other words, what I mainly did was I used the PhD program to help fill in my very, very bad education to help sort of repair the damage done all those years ago in Mississippi. And I had a wonderful literature teacher there, who was a guy from Harvard, who was a tremendously interesting guy, who did romanticism, British romantics, mainly. And so I really studied hard in that area, and I studied, he taught a course called The Long Poem in English that started with Spenser, and then did Milton, and then did Wordsworth's The Prelude. That was the whole semester. And that was a great course. So I did that kind of thing. And when I did my dissertation, though, that was a book of poems. And by the time I came to defend it, it was already accepted for publication by LSU Press, so that made the defense a pretty easy thing.
It certainly should have. Speaking of your poetry, how about another poem?
Oh, okay. Well, since we're talking about things southern, this book doesn't really have much in it about that place. My early work is where I put a lot more energy into writing poems about things from my childhood and my boyhood. And now I write about other things, but this particular poem revisits that scene. And I should explain going in here that you may remember this, but unless you're a certain age, you won't even know this fact. Back in the 50s, and I guess in the 40s, and probably from the late 40s to the middle 50s, if you would go into some shoe stores, you would find in there this kind of odd-looking machine, which when you tried on a pair of shoes, you could then walk over to this gadget and stick your feet in and look down through the top, and you could see your bones. It was an X-ray machine.
A fluoroscope, it was called.
Well, sort of, yeah, I guess. I mean, but it dealt with X-rays. I mean, it was a gadget. It worked that way because you didn't have to develop a piece of film. You could look down and see into your own body. How this was supposed to help you size a pair of shoes is beyond me. I mean, if you could look down and saw that the shoes you had picked out were crushing your bones, you might then make a different decision. But I don't know. They had these things. They were very strange, and then I think they realized that they might not be healthy, and so they got rid of them all. But one of those machines makes a cameo in this poem, which is set in the little town where I grew up. And the poem is called Impervious Blue. We walked down Main Street past the barbershop where men's heads hovered over tents of stained cloth, past the pharmacy, outside of which stood a marvelous machine that would weigh you and tell you the future if you dropped a penny in, and how I wanted to pull the lever and receive the news of futures that seemed inevitable. I would be homeless in winter, naked in an empty steel boxcar crusted with permafrost, or shipwrecked and pursued by rabid monkeys, I would fall into a pit of spiders. But my father refused. My future was not worth a penny. And we walked on past benches where black men in overalls sat talking quietly, watching us with tired eyes as we went past, their hands hard from cotton balls and wrenches, their work boots ruptured, 1957. There were futures no machine could fathom on the edge of their vision in Mississippi, not even the one in the store where we went to buy new shoes, where I stared through the scope at the ghost of my own toes, my precious white bones ghosted in X-ray far below me through a wormhole of darkness wherein I could see a city burning, pistols cracking skulls, children bleeding, and I was one of them, thrown to a curb in Chicago, Birmingham, Memphis, unconscious then as now, my shoeless feet bruised from white to impervious blue.
You painted a terrific picture there, both of the scene and also what was going on in the world. Extremely well done.
I should have mentioned, by the way, when you looked down through the machine and saw your bones, they looked blue. That was the point of that whole impervious blue thing. I should have mentioned that. That was the
color.
That's
funny. I I thought they were green in my Buster Brown
Some of them
store.
Were. Some of them were.
Yeah,
I
but mean, they were the same kind of thing, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, there seemed to be two different kinds. There was one kind that yielded up blue images and one kind that yielded up green. We had a blue one.
Before returning specifically to your poetry, let's touch a few of the bases. And you know, to me, you mentioned that you'd also been a musician. Was that from early on in your life?
Yeah, in a sense. That is, when I was 9 years old, they did that thing that they used to do. Maybe they still do it. I don't know. They sort of rounded up all the interested children and brought them into the band room with their parents nearby, because the parents were the ones that had the money. And some music dealer, and you know, they usually, every school seemed to have a connection with a particular music store. We had a connection actually with Peavy's Music Store in Meridian, Mississippi, which is the place where Peavy guitars and amplifiers now are made and come from. I don't know if you know that brand or not, but Peavy amplifiers are like everywhere now. And to me, this is kind of an interesting thing, because in the old days, I knew Peavy's as just this little mom and shop music store. And it was the son who invented the amplifier. He just copied a Fender amp, you know, and started selling his own amps, and it just took off like a rocket. But anyway, they brought in all the band instruments, you know, trombones and trumpets and clarinets and flutes and what have you. And basically they just turned us, the idea was we were going to walk all around with our parents and look at them and try to decide if we felt attracted to one or wanted one or whatever, and then would become part of the band program. So I, for some reason, and I cannot now even tell you why, but I remember it just as clear as day. I was 9 years old. I walked straight over to an alto saxophone. In its case, the interior, it was open, the case, and the interior of the case was navy blue fuzzy stuff, you know, and the saxophone lay there, this beautiful gold object. I remember it as clearly as I remember anything in my life. It was a Kahn beginner sax. That's the company that made it. And my mother was right behind me, and I said, I want this. And so my mother and father conferred, and they bought it for me. It didn't cost very much. It was an inexpensive beginner's instrument. And I started playing it. Now, I don't know why the saxophone. No idea. If I knew what a saxophone was supposed to sound like at that time, I can't remember that. I don't think I'd ever heard a saxophone. Probably I had on the radio or on TV. You played the Peter Gunn theme at the top of the show, which is a song I remember with great affection from the days of my youth. And that, of course, features a saxophone, as do many television theme songs, especially ones from the 50s and 60s. But if I knew that was a saxophone, I couldn't tell you that. But I wanted that thing. I wanted it because it was beautiful and because it was intricate, you know. The thing about saxophones is that they are machines. Trumpets are plumbing. but the saxophone is machinery. I mean, and that's actually literally true. Musical instruments develop in lockstep with technologies of various kinds. You know, the pipe organ is architecture. The violin is craftsmanship. It's woodcraft. It's furniture. Saxophones are machines. They developed in the machine age in the late 19th century. Trumpets developed a lot earlier, you know, and they are made of pipes and valves, plumbing. So anyway,
thing to rhythm and blues music before the electric guitar became so important. Many of the bands I listened to, Sam the Man Taylor, Red Prysock, Al Sears, they were all fronted by the tenor or alto saxes.
Yeah, mostly tenor. I mean, that's absolutely true. And you know, it's interesting that you know about Prysock, because he's a forgotten man. You know, nobody remembers Prysock, but he was a great player. I didn't hear him at the time. I only heard him later on when I was kind of excavating that music. But you're absolutely right. It was essential for early, and when I say early, I mean in the 40s and early 50s, for early rhythm and blues bands, which then became early rock and roll bands, to have a saxophone. And in fact,
when I first started playing, I got
into that, into bands,
Call them
and we had saxophones, and then suddenly they didn't have saxophones anymore. So my bandmate said to me, could you learn to play guitar instead, please? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I said that one of the songs from that period that was one of my favorites was Sam the Man Taylor, Harlem Nocturne.
Oh, yeah.
On his sax, yeah. So.
Yep, and then that later became, I mean, his version was really kind of jazz/R&B.
Right.
Later on, it was covered by a white rock and roll band, and it was really a rock and roll tune then. But you know,
so you went on. You went on to the guitar then, huh?
I did, yeah. Though I never excelled on the guitar, not excelled on the saxophone either. But guitar was important to me because I didn't have a teacher of music at all. It was the band director, you know, who herded us into the big room and helped us spend money, and probably I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't get some kind of kickback from those folks for instruments that were bought. But that's okay. I mean, he was a school teacher and he needed the money. But he was the only music teacher in the whole school system, you know, from about fourth grade all the way through 12th grade. So he was spread very thin. But also, he really didn't know how to teach anything. So he didn't teach me anything about saxophone. I just started figuring it out on my own. And one of the things that was mysterious to me, or that was unknown to me, was harmony. Because the saxophone can only produce one note at a time. But the first time I picked up a guitar, I realized, hey, there's six notes here. And then I had to figure out chords, and so I started teaching myself a little bit about theory with a guitar. So that was important to me too.
It's interesting how when they moved to rock, and as I said, I was an early R&B person. Then of course you had the driving guitars of Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry, and that kind of changed the whole kind of music that you listened to then. But,
yeah, it sure did, and that was okay, you know. And then as soon as the Beatles came along, everything changed again.
Yeah, yeah. You've also taught at various colleges all over the country. Could you take us on that tour?
Yeah, I was an academic migrant worker. I took a job straight out of graduate school, out of the University of Utah, at Oklahoma State University. In Stillwater, Oklahoma, which was an interesting place to live. It was for me personally not a great place to be because it was not a place that really had much. It didn't offer much for single adults. If you had a family and you kind of lived in that kind of housing and so on, then you were okay. Or if you were a student, you were okay. But if you were a single adult, there was no place even really to live. So I think I was there for 4 years, and I think I moved like eight times. But the one thing that was really great about Oklahoma was that the music there was interesting to me. I didn't really know much about Western swing music until I went to Oklahoma, and then it was everywhere there. And it's great music, and there were terrific musicians around that town.
Hank Thompson.
I played in a band in Stillwater. It's a long story. I need not go into it all, but it was a very good band. And we held down a gig. I was teaching at the university, but I also had this other life as a musician. So we played almost every weekend. We played Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights in this one bar from 9 o'clock until 2 in the morning. It was a very long gig. But it was like the core gig in the town, so that every other musician in town, when they finished at midnight, which most of them did, they would come down to Willie's where we were, and they would all sit in with us. And there was this one guy named Jimmy LaFave who used to come down. Now, Jimmy went on to have a real career in Austin. He just died a little while ago, but he was a very good musician. And I got to play with him, and there was another guy around there. The guys in the band that I was playing in used to say, because they never really had very much money or anything. They were very dedicated to music and to smoking funny cigarettes, which they did a lot. And they were sweethearts. They were three brothers. They were great guys, but they weren't very organized, right? So anyway, they used to say, back in our hometown, which is the next town down the road, there's this other guy, this other musician, who we don't really like him all that much, but he's got backing in the town. The people like the bank is putting money into him, and they're saying that he's going to go far, and he wants us to be their backup band. And we don't want to do it. So after I left town, about a year later, they actually finally did do it. And the guy from the next town was Garth Brooks.
Right.
Yeah, so they became Garth Brooks' band for a couple of years. I mean, of course, as soon as Garth Brooks started to get big and went to Nashville, he dropped them immediately. But, you know, they did that. So there was a lot of good music around there. But for 3 years, I played with that band, and I learned a lot about a lot of music that I didn't know anything about, like Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and those people. And I wrote a lot of poetry.
And were you writing your own stuff then, since you're both a poet and a musician?
I'm sorry, was I writing what?
Were you writing songs also, since you're both a poet?
Oh, songs. Well, you know, I did write some songs then, but... And I tried to work with the guys in the band on them, but it turned out they weren't interested. I think that the leader of the band wanted to write his own songs, and he didn't want another songwriter in the band. So I drifted away from that. I did some songwriting for a while, and then I stopped doing it until I got to Phoenix later on, and then I collaborated with somebody who really was a pro.
I had a poet on about a month ago, Reggie Mara, who sent off a whole thing of his material to the president and to Congress. He raised money for it, and I said, "How'd you get into poetry?" He said, "The first time I heard Kris Kristofferson, I said, this is what I want to do." It's interesting how it goes both ways.
Yeah, well, there's a deep connection between poetry and music. You know, I mean, before there were, you know, you talked about Gutenberg a while ago. Before the show, we were talking about technology and how it changes people's brains, and how the printing press changed culture. Before that, you know, poetry, of course, is thousands of years old, but written poetry, textual poetry, is quite new by comparison. So for all those thousands of years, people, quote-unquote, wrote poems. They didn't really write them. They composed them. And mostly they, quote-unquote, published them by singing them. You know, poems and songs were indistinguishable. And it's only relatively recently that connection has been lost. People forgot about it. So, you know, when Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, I was delighted. I thought that was a great move. I know some people weren't happy about it. But I think that, you know, if we've had... an important American poet since Whitman, one might say it's Dylan.
And also some of the Paul Simon things, The Sound of Silence and things like that, were just terrific poetry, I thought.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and there's some songwriters whose lyrics are closer to textual poetry than others, but I would maintain that if you're going to talk about a connection between poetry and music, you have to be prepared to talk about any kind of song, just as you have to be prepared to talk about any kind of poem. So I've thought a lot about this, because I have a friend who teaches he's a chairman of the English department at Catholic University in D.C., who teaches a class called Poetry and Rock and Roll. And I've kind of been a satellite part of that class off and on over the years. He's been teaching it for first time he taught it, I was living in Richmond, Virginia, teaching at Virginia Commonwealth University. So, geez, that was 20 years ago. Ernie's been teaching this class for a long time. It's the most popular class at Catholic. And he has people come in. You know, he's a friend of the Allman Brothers, and he knows Derek Trucks and those people. So they come into his class. And, you know, I went in, poets go in. And the students are fascinated by this connection. But I had this conversation with Ernie. Ernie has a lot of us writing about this now. So I just got done writing a paper for Ernie that's about James Brown and his song Cold Sweat, which is in some ways analogous to textual poetry. The lyrics of that song are not interesting at all. I mean, they're just song lyrics, you know. They're just cookie-cutter song lyrics. But when Brown sings this with that band, the Famous Flames, which is such a tremendously good band, it rises to the level of poetry, in my opinion. You know, and this paper makes a detailed case for that, which I won't go into because it's kind of technical. But I believe that. I believe that if what we do as people who write poetry, as opposed to sing it, people who write it, is to create a text on a piece of paper that other people are supposed to read and be somehow moved or changed by, you know, fill in the blanks with your favorite word for what you think poetry is supposed to do to its audience. Part of what many of us are doing, I wouldn't say that every poet does the same thing, but I used to tell my students, look, this piece of paper that you're writing on has no voice. It can't speak. But the reader must not think that. This piece of paper that you're writing on has no body. It has no body language. It has no tone of voice. But people must not think that when they read it. This piece of paper that you're writing on does not have a drum set, a bass player, and a guitar player in it. You have to build the rhythm section in so that your poem will sing. This is what your craft is as a poet, and that's something I believe that we have to sort of basically when we write a poem on a piece of paper, we're writing a score, like, you know, music, a piece by Chopin for the piano, right? We're writing a score, but it's a score for consciousness. And we have to write it in such a way that a reader can pick it up, but the reader has to work too, just like a musician has to. You know, I pick up a score to play, you know, a jazz tune on the saxophone. I have to be able to read music. I have to be able to play the saxophone. You pick up a poem, you have to be prepared to do what the poem needs for you to do, and that takes some work. But from the writer's side, your job is to build a score that a reader can perform mentally, but if the performance is in consciousness.
Yeah, one of the first, to go back just for 1 second to the music and poetry, one of the first books I remember starting like this, and I didn't read the whole thing, it got put down someplace, was an academic book about Jim Morrison is writing as a poet and comparing him to one of the famous French poets.
Rimbaud.
And I thought, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Also,
well, I mean,
you
Morrison,
mentioned what you
Morrison
have,
modeled himself on Rimbaud. I mean, that particular one is kind of obvious, but it is interesting that there's that. You know, Dylan, of course, refers to Rimbaud among others. Because he was a renegade, he was interesting to the rock and rollers.
And to Woody Guthrie.
To Woody Guthrie too, sure. Who was also a kind of renegade in his own way.
The other point was you mentioned what you have to do with a poem. I personally find the hardest thing to write is a short story, because in a very confined space you have to have plot, characters, tone, you have to have so many things that you don't really need in your own poems, where it's you're pouring out of you, and you don't need it in a novel where you have time to build all these things. Now, I know that some people find short story writing much easier than I do, but I don't. So.
Well, you know, different people seem to be, for whatever reason, different writers seem to be equipped to sort of perform in specific genres. I have a friend named Alan Weyer, who's a novelist, and Alan came to one of my creative writing classes once, and one of the students had the wit to ask him, Mr. Weyer, how did you find out you're a novelist? Which is an interesting question, if you think about it. How did you find out? And Alan he sat in it for about 2 seconds, and then he said, I found out that I was a novelist because I discovered that I could do it. Allen doesn't write short stories, he writes novels. Raymond Carver, who I knew a little, wrote short stories and he wrote poems. He didn't write novels. His publisher desperately wanted him to write a novel because Carver had become so famous. It's almost unheard of for a short story writer to become as famous as Raymond Carver was. But they desperately wanted him to write a novel because they were convinced that they could make tons of money on it. So, you know, they would give him money to take time off from teaching and go off into the wilderness someplace and write a novel. And Ray said, well, I took the money and I went out to the cabin in the woods and I just spent a whole year doing nothing but writing poems and laughing. He just wasn't interested in writing a novel, and he probably didn't have it in him. You know, I mean, that's another kind. It's like asking a sprinter to run a marathon.
Yeah, absolutely. Do publish in literary journals throughout the country, as well as in some prestigious mainstream publications such as the New Yorker, Paris Review, Atlantic Monthly, and Harper's, magazines that most poets would give a digit to be accepted by. If you had to provide the focus for the audience on your writing, what would it be if you could narrow it at all?
Yeah, you mean something specific to read?
Something that you feel has made you not only being able to write from your own voice, but to write to such wonderful publications that are interested in publishing you.
I can't answer that question exactly because what you know I've also been an editor of three major literary magazines. I edited the Kenyon Review, and I was editor in chief of the New England Review, and I was editor in chief of the Georgia Review. Not at the same time, you know, at different times. And I can tell you that it's almost impossible. You know, I've known a lot of editors. More maybe than some people have, and also have been one myself. I spent about 20 years doing that, and I can tell you that it's imponderable what makes the light bulb in an editor's head turn on. You know, you can't second guess that process. And so, you know, if I have published poems in a New Yorker, that is good luck for me. But you know, when I first published in a New Yorker. And I just use that as a convenient example because it's sort of the most prominent, although also in some ways for poetry, one of the most ridiculed magazines in the country. People mock the poems, poets often mock the poems in the New Yorker because the New Yorker does tend to take a certain kind of poem. And no matter who's editing it, the editor doesn't get to make the decision all by himself or herself. There are editors above who check it for content and that kind of thing. And in fact, the New Yorker is the only magazine I know of that fact checks your poems. So if there's a fact in there that a quote unquote fact, you know, in your poem, they double check it and make sure that kind of car was actually published, was actually built in that year, et cetera. You know, and if they find that there's a problem, they'll write to you. Which is very odd. But in any case, the editor then, you know, for that magazine is making a different set of editorial decisions than the editor for a smaller magazine that's more completely independent of any kind of sense of offending an audience or something like that. I'm very grateful, I will say, though, to the New Yorker because everybody sees it. You know, when I published, the first time I published a poem in the New Yorker, about six months later, I heard from my uncle who I didn't even know he read anything ever. Certainly he didn't read poetry, but he went to the doctor, and in the doctor's waiting room there was an old copy of the New Yorker. He picked it up, and my poem was in it. So, you know, I mean, the New Yorker gets around. But I found from early on that if I just sent out a lot of poems to a lot of magazines that eventually they would land somewhere. And why? I don't know. I mean, I write as well as I can and hope and send stuff out, and people either take it or they don't. I get rejected as much as anybody else. But, you know, I have a decent track record that way. Oh, but I was going to say that just as part of the example, that the first editor at the New Yorker who took poems of mine was Howard Moss back in the early 80s. Howard Moss had been the poetry editor of the New Yorker for a long time, and he liked my poems. When he left, he retired, Alice Quinn took over as the editor, and she was not interested in my poems. So for a period of probably 20 years or so, as long as Alice Quinn was the editor of the New Yorker, I didn't publish there. When Alice Quinn left, Paul Muldoon came on as editor of the New York Poetry at the New Yorker, and he liked my poems, and so he started taking them again. Now, he's left, and Kevin Young is editing the Poetry of the New Yorker, and I haven't sent any yet. So it remains to be seen how Kevin reacts.
You don't know. You mentioned your editing. I know you're also with Quarterly West and the Cimarron Review, and you with the New England Review twice, and the Kenner Review, and as you mentioned, the Georgia Review. How did you get involved, and what took you from one publication to another?
Well, you mean, how did I get involved in editing?
Yes.
I edited the undergraduate magazine at University of Southern Mississippi, which, of course, is, by comparison, a tiny job, but it was fun. And so I had a little bit of the nuts and bolts knowledge from that. Of course, all that nuts and bolts knowledge, by the way, is completely obsolete now. You'll know what I mean. The magazines aren't printed even remotely in the same way now as they were then. But anyway, then when I went to University of Utah, Quarterly West was a magazine that was run by the graduate students in the creative writing program. And so when I became a third-year student, the editorship was open, and I applied for it and got it. Actually, I don't think anybody else wanted it, but I did get it, and I did edit the magazine for that year, just for 1 year, which was the term of the editorship of Quarterly West in those days. So then I had a bit more editorial experience. When I went then to Oklahoma State University, Cimarron Review is there, and I was immediately offered the poetry editorship of Cimarron, which is all I did with Cimarron. I didn't edit any of the fiction or any of the prose, nor did I have anything to do with the production of the magazine. I just chose poems, which actually is a pretty great gig. I wouldn't mind doing that again. I won't edit a magazine again like I did at Kenyon and at New England Review and at Georgia Review, because it's just more work than I now am capable of. But just editing the poetry at a magazine like Cimarron was wonderful, and it was fun. So anyway, then when I went to Kenyon, now that's a whole different level of playing field, so to say. The Kenyon Review, of course, is a very famous magazine. And I was at Kenyon for 5 years, and I could tell a whole bunch of stories about that, but it gets to be too complicated. But suffice it to say that I was in England for one of those years, you know, on a Kenyon program in England. And while I was there, the phone rang, and the president of the college was on the phone, and he said, "When you come back from England, we want you to take over the editorship of the Kenyon Review." And we talked about this for a while and agreed then that, in fact, though it's more complicated than it sounds, I agreed to take it over and did take it over. And it was an interesting experience because the Kenyon Review is so famous in a way and yet so in people's minds it's a fixed thing, or it was then. It may not be so much now, but it certainly was then. Again, we're talking about the late 80s, that, for instance, I became alarmed when I realized how much of the mail that came in to the Kenyon Review was addressed to John Crow Ransom, who was the poet who had established the Kenyon Review in the 30s. And by the time I was editing the review, he'd been dead for 25 years and hadn't been the editor of the review in probably 35 years. You know, he retired and then, you know, lived 10 years or so and died. But the mail kept coming addressed to him. And after a while, I started thinking, how long will I have to stay at this magazine before it makes any kind of a dent in this sense of this magazine that people have that is still being edited by John Crow Ransom? How can I change that? And that kind of drove me out of the job. I got an offer then to go and take over a smaller magazine, really, called the New England Review. And I thought, well, if I take that magazine, I can do more with it in a short time than I can here. It will take me decades here to make this magazine have my imprint on it instead of John Crow Ransom's. Whereas if I take over this other magazine, it'll be much easier. And that turned out to be true.
At least they'll know who I am.
Yeah. So I edited that magazine for a few years and then left. I went from Kenyon. This goes all the way back to your question about the different schools I was at. I was at Oklahoma State. I moved from Oklahoma State to Kenyon College. And I was at Kenyon College for 5 years, and then I moved from there to Middlebury College, because that's where the New England Review was. And the then editor of the New England Review, who was the establishing editor, the founding editor of it, was retiring from it and he specifically wanted me to do it because he and I had worked together before. And he said, you will continue this magazine in the same tradition in which, you know, the spirit in which I founded it. I would like you to do it. So I took that job, and I did that for a while. And then I took another job at the University of Oregon because I felt at that point that I would like to teach graduate students again. And, you know, Middlebury College doesn't have any. Neither does Kenyon. So I went to Oregon and was in the MFA program there for a while. Then I went to Virginia Commonwealth University, and from there I was hired. And all those years at Oregon and in Richmond, I wasn't editing. I was out of editing. I thought I was tired of that. I didn't want to do it anymore. But then I got the opportunity to edit the Georgia Review. And I don't know if your listeners know the Georgia Review or what the Georgia Review was like, especially in the 80s and 90s, but it was a very, very fine magazine. And the editor who had made it so had been very successful at setting up an organization that was impressively large, at least, put it that way. There were 7 full-time employees working at the Georgia Review, which is unheard of in a literary magazine. That's a lot of people. It was just operating on a whole different level. You know, the other magazines I had been at, you know, it was just like me and one or two other people, and none of us were full-time doing that. We were all doing other things as well. So at Georgia, it was really concentrating now on the editing, and that was really a spectacularly amazing experience. It was a great magazine and a great experience editing it. But I finally got exhausted.
Was that when you went back to New England Review?
No, I didn't go back to New England Review. When I left Georgia, I went to Arizona State University, and I was no longer editing.
Okay. Your writing has also won you a National Endowment for the Arts and Guggenheim Fellowships, 2 Pushcart Prizes, a Donald Justice Award for Poetry, and an inclusion in the Best American Poetry Annual Collection. Tell us about some of those honors.
Well, those kinds of things are fabulous, especially when there's a check attached. Like, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts one is really, in a sense, it's nothing but a check. Because that's what it's for. You know, they give money to support our writers and other artists in their work and to free them up, you know, for certain spans of time to do their work without distraction from other duties. Likewise, the Guggenheim, that's what the Guggenheim is for. And so those kinds of things are particularly terrific because basically, it's a great honor, and a check comes with it, and some time comes with it, and that's terrific. The other things are contests. I mean, not contests necessarily, but they are awards that are made by or given by organizations simply based on the quality of work. And the best ones are the ones that you don't apply for or anything. Just out of the blue, you get a letter in the mail that says, "We like your poems, and we want to give you a prize, you know, in recognition." And those are particularly sweet. I mean, in a way, that's even better than the ones that come with a check attached. Though if they also came with a check attached, that would be all right. but it's the sort of out of the blue kind of, like the Donald Justice Prize. That was how that was. It was just like there's no application process. I got an email saying that you are if you wish to accept it, you are next year's recipient of this award for the following reasons. You know, sometimes it's for an individual book, sometimes it's for the body of work. As the also the Richard Wright Award for Literary Excellence was like that. So, you know, those are good. The Pushcart Prize is something that is kind of a special one. You probably know, and your audience may also know how the pushcart works. Work published in a given year in magazines or in books that are independent press books, as opposed to, you know, big press books, can be nominated for pushcart prizes by editors or by other writers. And so one is nominated for that, not by one's own effort, but by other people. And then, you know, you wait around, and if you win, they let you know. Now, it's become really enormous. And so if I hear somebody say, oh, well, I'm so honored my poem was nominated for a pushcart prize, I always think, well, that is not much of an honor, because you and 5,000 other poets have been nominated for pushcart prizes this year alone. But to win one is great. You know, that's a really good thing. And to have won two of them is a nice thing indeed. I'm very pleased about that. But the whole contest and prize thing is like the lottery. You know, your work is your lottery ticket, and you know, somebody picks it somehow. And maybe, if you're lucky, and then for a little while, you're the winner.
You also have a number of published poetry collections. You mentioned one of them earlier. Please give the audience the summary of these titles.
A summary of titles is difficult, but my first little book, it was a chapbook, but it was a very beautifully produced chapbook. It was a hardback chapbook. It was called Translation of Light. It was published by a press called Cedar Creek Press that no longer exists, and it's impossible to find. Cedar Creek Press didn't even register it. It doesn't have an ISBN number. So it's almost vanished without a trace. There are like 500 copies of this book in the world somewhere. I have two of them. But it was great because I was 26 years old, when it actually came out, I was 27, because it came out later than it was supposed to. Big surprise there. But the day my first child was born, I came home from the hospital and found a package outside my door, and it was the first copies of that book. So that seemed like a nice piece of symbolism to me. That book was published a very long time ago. I was very young, too young, and probably shouldn't have been published. Although when I look at it now, I think the poems aren't bad, but I don't know who wrote them. The first full-length book was a book called The Angelic Orders, and that was my dissertation at the University of Utah. It came out in 1982 from LSU Press, and then I had a book called The Passion of the Right-Angled Man, then one called Lower Class Heresy. Those two books came out from University of Illinois. And
two good titles.
Then I had a book called The 18,000-Ton Olympic Dream. The Olympic Dream was a ship that sank in the Mediterranean, a 19,000-ton oil tanker. So The 18,000-Ton Olympic Dream was the title of that book. It was published by William Morrow. Then it was my one venture into New York trade publishing for poetry, which was great for about 3 months, because it was in every bookstore on earth. It was in airport bookstores. I've never had a book of mine sold in an airport bookstore, but that one was in at least one airport bookstore. But then they remaindered it without my knowledge after it was out for only 3 months, because William Morrow almost went under. It was when all the big presses in New York were being eaten by Macmillan. And Morrow got eaten by Macmillan, and for a while it was not clear even whether William Morrow was going to continue to exist, much less its poetry series, which didn't exist anymore after that. My book was the last one that came out in that series. And so I called him up and said, this is against the contract. You can't remainder the book without telling me. And they said, oops, we're sorry. We can't help it. It's gone. And I said, well, can I get some copies? And they said, sorry, we sold them all to Borders. But here's a number you can call for the Borders people. So I called a couple of numbers, and they sent me to talk to some guy in a warehouse in Buffalo. They said, all the copies of this book are in that warehouse, so call up this guy. So I called him up, and I told him his whole story, and he said, oh. He said, well, yeah, we have those books here. We've already made our money back out of them, so I'll tell you what, if you want them, I'll just send them to you for free. Give me your address. So I gave him the address, and of course they never arrived. And I called him again about 6 months later, and we had exactly the same conversation and exactly the same result. So that book just vanished. You know, it was like the rapture of poetry books. Anyway, after that, I published a book called Walt Whitman in Hell, which in many ways I think is my best book, or it's my most. Yeah, well, put it this way, it was the book that was for me the most difficult to write. It almost killed me to write that book because I made it so difficult on purpose. I mean, I was trying to do things I didn't know how to do, and I did that on purpose because I wanted to change the way I wrote. And that experiment succeeded for me. You know, I mean, it really did make a difference. It was very hard to do. And when I got to the end of it, I said, I never want to have this experience with my poetry again. From now on, I will write a different kind of poem yet. And so that's what I've been doing the whole time since then. That book came out in 1990-something, 1992 or 3. And since then, I've still published, let's see, I published Useless Virtues and The Infinity Sessions. And then I wrote a trilogy of books of poetry. Three books called, one's called Ephemeron, one's called Scandalon, and one is called Eon. And Eon just came out this year. I have two books out this year, just by accident, in the same year. I say by accident because the publisher of Eon just took a very long time to get it out. And the publisher of After the Afterlife was very quick, and so it just happened that they coincided in the same year, but that wasn't by design. But anyway, I wrote and published that trilogy of books of poetry. And then I published one more book, which is the one I've been reading from, After the Afterlife.
After all your national traveling, what brought you to the Hudson Valley?
I married a lady who lives here, and she has a house, so I'm living in it. I retired from Arizona State after 40 years in rank, and remarried, and I'm living here in the Hudson Valley with my wife, who is the writer, Elizabeth Kimmel. Elizabeth Cody Kimmel, who has been mostly a writer of books for children and for what the publishers call mid-grade kids, which are kids between the ages of 8 and 12 or so, and young adults. Beth has published over 40 books, so she's on a roll.
I was just about to ask you about her when you said 40 books. I was I'd already seen that, and I was bowled over by that. There are many both geographic career stops and your career stops have probably given you insights into regionalism, racism, and polarization throughout the country. Would you like to share your thinking on any of these matters with the audience?
Yeah, well, it was, in a way, it was by design that I moved around. I mean, there were a lot of people are hired in a university or a college and either maybe move once or don't move at all, which is great. I mean, there's a way in which if you stay in one institution, you become really part of the fabric of that institution. And I've seen professors, you know, in at the end of those kinds of arcs who had been very, very happy to be affiliated with a particular institution that they are part of, which is great. I have always not been a joiner. And I think it probably comes from that moment in my adolescence when I realized that everything that I had been told, everything that I had been that I'd been led to assume about who I was and who my community was all based on a pack of lies and deception and theft and everything else, by which I just simply mean Jim Crow racism, that I don't trust institutions very much, and I don't really attach myself to them in that way. I attach myself to my students. You know, I had very, very good experiences in all the schools where I taught with students and with my colleagues too. You know, I attach myself to people, but not so much to institutions. So that for me, it was easy enough to be able to pick up and move. There are advantages to it because in academia, once they have you, they won't really give you much of a pay raise. But if you move, you can negotiate your salary up, so that helps. But really, the motivation was to be in those different places and to be part of them. And I should include England as one of my stops along the way because I did teach at an English university for a year. I was sent there by Kenyon. They have a program there. But I became, for that year, a professor in that university. And that was a very, very fascinating experience because their system is so different from ours. And so that, too, is part of my particular experience as an academic in motion, so to say. But I'm very glad to have lived in all the different places I lived. I like some of the places better than others. But in many ways, I liked them all and learned from them all, benefited from being in them. It's a very different proposition to live in a relatively small college town in Oklahoma than it is to live in Richmond, Virginia, and teach at an inner-city university. You know, those experiences are hardly even comparable. And to have had the opportunity to do not only those two, but, you know, many other variations of the same theme is really a great privilege, and I'm grateful for it.
What's next for you?
I'll probably die next, I think. No, you know, I'm retired, and so I'm at the end of that particular arc of my life. So what's next for me is to do as much writing as I can and to try to make sure that my family and my children all prosper as much as I can make sure that they do. That's what I'm doing now.
We've covered a lot of different bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about T.R. Homer?
Well, I would like them to know that that if they see me reading poems on a street corner on a Saturday morning, they should put $1,000 in the cup next to my face. That would be a good start. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, it would be nice for your readers to know that that my latest book, After the Afterlife, is published by a wonderful new press in Ohio called Acre Books. I want to give Acre a little plug because they're such, I think, a promising new press, doing such good work. My book is the first poetry book they've ever published, and we agreed that we would take a chance on each other. You know, the editor said, "Are you sure you want to publish with a brand new press? We have no track record." And I said, "Well, I trust you because I know the editor. She's somebody I worked with when she worked at another press." And I said, "Nicola, I know you and I trust you. If you have a new enterprise, I'm happy to be part of it. Publish my book." So they did, and they did a beautiful job. It's very well produced. It's a good book. So go on Amazon.com and look up After the Afterlife from Acre Books. And the other new book, by the way, which I would also like your readers to think about, is Eon, which came out from LSU Press this year and is the third of and final book in that trilogy I was talking about. So there it is. They can, your listeners can all go off and order all my books and read them all on a Tuesday evening, and then they can write me letters and ask me why the hell I do that.
I'll be happy to do that myself. Would you take us out with another poem?
Okay, I can do that. Hold on, I got dropped the book. See, the experience of reading poems on the telephone is kind of new. I have to hold the book with my left hand. But this is a poem about the fact that we have a beagle in the house. And when I grew up on a farm, dogs didn't come in the house. My father wouldn't stand for it. And so they all worked outside. They worked, and they lived outside. Now we have this beagle in the house, and I can, if any of your listeners have a beagle, I'm sure that they love it dearly, and they also know what difficult animals beagles are, because they're not really supposed to live in the house. They're supposed to live outside with other beagles. not in the house with people. So they become very difficult, sometimes difficult to train. So this is a poem called Anger Management, and it features, though he is not named, it features Henry the Beagle. It also features Friedrich Nietzsche, but he is named. I was angry. Dog pulled my copy of On the Genealogy of Morals off the table and chewed on it for half a day in the alcove before I found out. I managed to drag one sentence out of his slathering jaws. Of necessity, we remain strangers to ourselves. And I found the utterance uncharacteristically damp for Nietzsche. The rest of the book was inside the dog, and you know what that means. He had swallowed, "We are noble, good, beautiful, and happy." Swallowed it whole, dumb mutt, and I knew I'd find it on the lawn in a day or two, alongside, "Nothing is true, everything is permitted." He was digesting that one at this very moment, thereby undoing $400 worth of dog obedience class. I tell you, I was furious. It was my favorite book. I'd owned it for decades. Its marginalia traced the history of my conscience. I coaxed him out of hiding. I gave him a cookie. I stroked his ears and went on reading Nietzsche in my head. Each one of us is farthest away from himself. I could not punish a dog for only doing the same thing I had done, but more quickly and more efficiently. This satisfied Nietzsche, who scratched my belly, threw a ball across the room, and stood with his hand out, waiting.
I love it. And I have a dog that rules the house after not being able to have one because I was greatly allergic to one. I didn't find out until 9 years ago that I could have the ones that have the curly hair that you have to spend lots of money to have done rather than hair that sheds in the house. And I have had friends with beagles, and they are a breed of their own, that I understand.
Well, they're curious animals. They're all nose and stomach. You know, it's like Henry can't, he can't not attend to what he smells because he's bewitched by it. You know? So it makes life interesting.
Terry, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, John. It's an honor, and it's been fun.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us next week for my interview with poet and poetry of Culture Weekly, Alexis Ron Fanchet, at the same time. And as in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. And until next time, as he's saying in the old neighborhood, see ya. Now let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling, please.
Here's Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
The way you talk past me and feeling down
against your skin so brown, and I wanna sleep with you in the desert night with a billion stars all around, 'cause I got
a peaceful easy feeling.
Thank you again, Terry. And good night, everybody.
Thank you, John. Good night.